I am very grateful to be with all of you this evening. My special gratitude to all the esteemed VIPs who spoke so graciously with such wisdom and kindness. And my gratitude to all of you who have taken your precious time to be here this evening. In 1969, my beloved Guru, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, was being interviewed in London, England. Like many journalists, this person was quite challenging. He said, "Swamiji, why have you come to our country? We have our own religions, we have our own culture. Why have you come?" Srila Prabhupada replied that your British Empire controlled India for almost 2 centuries. And during that time, you took so much of the treasures, the wealth of India, and brought it to London. But you forgot to take the most priceless of all wealth of India, its spiritual culture. I have come to England to give to you freely what you forgot to take. Perhaps the greatest wealth that has been stolen from India is the influence in which so many people of India have forgotten the value of their spiritual culture. It was this wealth that I was looking for in my life. And that is the story of this book, The Journey Home. Actually, I never wanted to write this book. Many, many people asked me to write it since the year 1972 when I told some stories. And I always said, I will never write such a book. So many pages describing the words I, me, and mine. It would be an act of arrogance to write this book. And besides that, if I tell the truth, I don't think anyone will believe it. But then, one of my very dearest friends, a beloved Swamiji, I was at his bedside when he was just passing from the world. And he made me promise that I would write this book and publish it. And then he said, "You cannot lie to a man on his deathbed." So in his honor, I have written The Journey Home. It's about a boy born 1950 in the United States of America who grew into my teens in the 1960s, an extremely turbulent time. It was the time of the Vietnam War, And when you turn 18, you could be drafted and forced to go and kill or be killed for something we didn't even believe in. It was a time where if you had a different color skin than the majority of people, you were condemned to live and die in the ghettos. And we were told it was a free country. So the younger generation, many of us were really questioning. In fact, we were revolting against what we saw as hypocrisy. But after some time, I came to understand that we were just as hypocritical as the people we were revolting against, just in a different dress with a different ideology. And I came to the conclusion that if we want to make a difference in the world, we have to change ourselves. So in between college semesters, when I was 19 years old, myself and one friend decided to go on a trip to Europe. Not as tourists, but as seekers, trying to understand different ways of seeing life and the world. What do other people in other places think about society, of life? What is its purpose? What is its meaning? We had practically no money, and we were just wandering, hitchhiking through Europe. At one time, we were in Rome, Italy. And I was very much going to forests and riverbanks and cathedrals and monasteries and synagogues, trying to make sense of God. Because it seemed the more I saw the world, the more I saw hate in the name of a loving God. But I believed there was an essential truth in all these great spiritual paths that was beautiful. I was trying to find that. There was an underground catacomb, or underground basement, where for hundreds and hundreds of years, monks would put the skeletons of the predecessor monks. It was quite amazing. There was furniture, chandeliers, incredible designs on the walls made out of human bones. And we asked some monk, why do you come down here? What is this place for? And the monk told us that by seeing the people who live just like us, how now they're just skulls and bones, we understand how impermanent this world is. And it helps us to meditate on what is really meaningful in life. At the end of all of these various exhibitions of bones, human bones, there was several skeletons with monk robes on. And one of them was pointing to a sign, as if they were speaking to us. I'll never forget what that sign said. It said, "What you are now, we used to be. What we are now, you will be." I never thought dead skeletons would be my teachers. But it was, considering the state they were in, they were very convincing. So more and more I was turning toward understanding what is that truth beyond all the changing experiences of this life? What is God? Who am I? And what is my relationship? And is there actual solutions to the chronic problems within human society? At a certain time, I left my friend on the island of Crete of Greece because I had an inner calling to go to India. I hitchhiked essentially from London to the border of India. It took about 6 months. After crossing through India, through Europe and the Middle East, I went to the Himalayas. The first day, I was sitting alone in a forest on the bank of the Ganga near Rishikesh. And I was meditating and praying. And a sadhu came out of the forest and walked right up to me. He said, "You don't know who I am, but I know who you are. I've been watching you. Now take off your Western clothes and I will give you the robes of a sadhu." I asked him, "What is a sadhu?" I never heard the word before. He said, "A sadhu is a homeless wanderer looking for the truth." And I thought, that sounds like me. So I took off my jeans and I took off my shirt. And he said, "Put them in the Ganga." And I put them. And he told me to put my underpants in the Ganga. And I realized this was very serious. But I did. It was gone forever. And then he gave me a kopan, a loincloth, and a lungi, and a chadar, and taught me how to put it on. Then he said something very softly in my ear. He said, "The Ganges will become your mother. This will be revealed to you in time." And then he left, and I never saw him again. I sat on a rock in the Ganges for about a month and learned more by the grace of Mother Ganga, just observing the incredible lessons that she's teaching the world at every moment. And I was thinking, I've learned more sitting on this rock. I was doing a monavrat. I wasn't talking to anybody. I was living in a cave in a forest and coming out and sitting on this rock. I learned more sitting there than all the American schools and colleges that I went to. And later, I began wandering through the mountains of the Himalayas and the forests and the caves, living with different rishis and sadhus and gurus and lamas and yogis. At one time, I lived with this very old sadhu who was just homeless, wandering for over 50 years in the Himalayan forest. He was a devotee of Shiva. And he taught me how to live in the jungle and survive. What you can eat, what you cannot eat. What is medicinal, what is dangerous. And he taught me something else. How to live in harmony with our neighbors. Now, his name was Kailash Baba. Our only neighbors were the animals, snakes, and insects of the jungle, as well as the trees and the bushes. This was 1970. We would see leopards roaming around, sometimes wild elephants, sometimes cobras, vipers, wild boar, panthers, lots of monkeys, and even more mosquitoes. He told me, in his own way, that these animals, if you feel yourself superior to them, they will kill you. If you feel any fear of them, they will react and kill you. You have to understand that the living force within every leopard, every elephant, every snake is an Atma, a spirit soul, a part of God, a child of God. If you see them according to their external bodies, you're going to either feel fear or arrogance. But if you see them as your brothers and sisters, if you honor and respect the sacredness of life, they will honor and respect you. Now, in all the schools I went to previously, I had time to study before the exam. But the leopards were there. The snakes were there. I had to immediately understand this. But something amazing I learned. Because he had so much faith and realization of the sacredness of life, when I was with him, just by his company, his satsang, I could actually feel these animals and snakes as my brothers and sisters. I could feel love for them. And I felt that they loved me. God was loving me through all of them. The power of satsang, association, can actually transform us. I learned in that situation that in holy company, what is otherwise theoretical, academic, actually becomes practical and real. Because we need living examples to actually have faith. Another interesting thing is he didn't speak English. And I didn't speak Hindi. He taught me all these lessons because he just cared about me so much and wanted to give me his wisdom. And because I was so eager to receive it. When those two principles come together, the compassion to give and the eagerness to receive, the transmission of spiritual wisdom is beyond even language. I traveled on roaming through Himalayas. I lived at the burning ghats in Varanasi. And there I meditated on death from sunrise to sunset, watching body after body burning. And it was amazing because what I learned by watching this is how precious life is, how precious every moment is. Because as human beings, we have the opportunity, atato brahma jigyasa, to actually realize our eternal nature. Later, I was to learn from the Bhagavad Gita, najayate mriyate vakadachit, that the true self, who we really are, is never born and never dies. Cannot be cut into pieces by weapons. It cannot be burned by fire. We are a part of God. We are divine. Even if an atomic nuclear bomb falls directly on our head, it cannot cause any harm to the Atma, to our true self. Because we are Satchitananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. And the greatest potential we have is to feel ananda, the ecstasy of feeling God's love and loving God. Eventually, I came to Vrindavan. It's a very, very long and amazing story, because I was on my way somewhere else, but I was trapped in a place I didn't know where I was. It was Mathura on the day of Janmashtami. And then I was going to leave, and I got typhoid fever, and I couldn't leave. So I ended up living on the banks of the Yamuna River in Vrindavan. And by experiencing bhakti, the path of love, the path of devotion, by understanding the concept of Radha, the female compassionate nature of the one absolute truth, who in Vrindavan we call Krishna. And I saw how these people, they had such deep humility, such deep love. I lived for some every day I went to visit this one simple little man. His name is Ghanashyam. He told me his story. He was from a wealthy family. When he was a teenager, his family went on a pilgrimage to Vrindavan. This was long ago. And he became so moved by the atmosphere of devotion that he told his family, "I'm going to stay here for the rest of my life." And they tried to take him away, but he stayed. And now he was homeless. And one day, he was thinking, "I wish I had a deity, a murti to worship." But he had no money. He slept under trees. So he would just write Radha's name, Sri Radha, with his finger on the dirt. And he would worship the printed name on the earth throughout the day with flowers, and he would sing, and he would offer prayers. And then he would erase it in the evening. One night when he erased it, he saw something underneath. It looked kind of golden. And he came back later and dug it. And there were deities of Radha and Krishna. And inscribed in the bottom it said, Radha Gopi Jana Ballabha. He worshipped him under this tree. After some days, a family invited him to make a little temple in a closet in the common room. It was just like the hallway of a house. There was a little closet. When I came there, he had already been sleeping in the hallway and worshiping the deities in that closet for 50 years. Very simple man. Every day when I would come to his house, he would give me 3 rotis, braj rotis, very thick, coarse rotis. One day, I slept on the bank of Yamuna. I went to take my bath, and I came out. And this sadhu who would walk by every day, he was a Babaji, and he'd always give me some blessing. But on a particular day, he scolded me. He said, "You are so selfish." I said, "I know, but, you know, why are you saying it today?" He said, "Because of you, Ghanashyam is starving." I said, "I don't understand." He said, "He never leaves that closet. He stays with his Thakurji, with Radha Gopi Jana Ballabha. And a Brijabasi gives him 3 rotis every day to offer to his deities, and that's all he has to eat all day, and you are eating all his rotis." So later that day, I went to Ghanashyam's little closet temple. Really simple. And he came with a leaf plate and the 3 rotis. And he said, "Please honor Gopi Janaballabha's prasad." I said, "I am not hungry today." He said, "No, no, you must eat." I said, "I'm not hungry." He said, "No, no, you must eat." I said, "I've already eaten." He said, "Then you eat more." I said, "Ghanashyam, these are your only rotis. Because of you, because of me, you are starving." He said, "No, no, no, I have so many rotis." I said, "Ghanashyam, show me your other rotis." He said, "They are in there." And he pointed to a little part of the closet. So I went in and there was no rotis. I said, "Ghanashyam, there is no rotis. You eat. I can get rotis anywhere." With folded palms and tears in his eyes, he said, "Something I'll never forget." He said, "You are Gopi Jana Ballabha's friend. I am only the servant of the servant of his servants. My only happiness in life is to serve my Lord's devotees. If you don't take my rotis, it means that I must be so sinful. It's the only thing I live for is to serve. Please let me live." I cried and ate all his rotis for his pleasure. The next day I had a plan. I would come 3 hours later. That way for sure he would have eaten his rotis. When I came, in those days in Vrindavan, everyone called me Krishnadas. I came through the little door of the house, and he cried out, "Krishnadas, Krishnadas, Gopi Jana Ballabha has been waiting for you." And I looked, and the rotis were still on the altar. He said he will not eat without his friend. And again, he gave me all the rotis. I write many stories about this simple old man. And the reason I'm telling this story today, how the charm of bhakti affected my heart. I live with some of the greatest Sanskrit scholars. I live with yogis who could perform supernatural mystic siddhis or powers. I live with gurus who had millions of disciples. I live with people who practically didn't eat or sleep and lived in the caves of jungles. But the humility, the selfless love of someone like Ghanashyam, I understood, was a deeper spiritual perfection. I decided to never leave Vrindavan. And after some time, something amazing happened. A bus pulled into Vrindavan. Because in those days, it was just a forest with some simple ashrams and old temples. It's not like it is today as far as external. There were only two white people in all of Brajbhumi, myself and one other. And then a bus came with about 30 or 40 devotees of Krishna from Europe, from Japan, from America, from Africa. And the people of Vrindavan were astonished. It was the first time in history a group of people came from the West to worship Krishna. The mayor of the town and the chief Goswamis and priests of the town were all there to welcome this bus. And there Srila Prabhupada came out. And I was sleeping under trees on the Yamuna River and doing madhukari, just begging for some rotis. And I saw some of these Western people. They had shaved heads, they had tilak, they had dhoti, saris, and they were eating such good food. And some of them had tape recorders, and some of them had cameras. And I was thinking, what kind of sadhus is this? I live with so many sadhus, they never had cameras or tape recorders or ate jalebis. So I was actually thinking that because I was an ascetic, I was living so austere that I am better than them. I didn't like to feel like that, but I couldn't help it. But every day I would get up, take my bath, do my japa of chanting this Hare Krishna mantra on the bank of Yamuna, and then I would go to hear Srila Prabhupada speak in the morning. He was there about 10 days. And one morning, he was giving a talk. He said that the difference between material energy and spiritual energy is our consciousness. Om Purnam Ata Purnamidam Janmadyasayataha. The absolute truth is perfect and complete, and everything, all material and spiritual worlds, are coming from God or Krishna. If we see the things of this world through the eyes of our false ego, ahankar, then we think, I am the controller, I am the proprietor, I am the enjoyer. Then we are perceiving material energy. But if we see, bhoktaram jagatapasam sarva loka maheshwaram, that everything is God's property. I'm the caretaker
Yat karosi yat ashnasi yat truhoshti tatasiyat.
And we utilize whatever we have in God's service. Then everything becomes spiritual. And he gave an analogy. He said, this microphone I'm speaking in, if I speak some material things or sing some material songs, then this microphone is perceived as material energy. But if I use the same microphone to glorify Krishna, then we're understanding the spiritual potential. The microphone is inseparable energy of Krishna. And everything in this world, if we have this spirit of seva, unselfish service, we could spiritualize everything in this world. While he was saying this, I was thinking, these people who I'm criticizing in my mind about having cameras and tape recorders, they're using it all in Krishna's service. And I'm judging them because I'm thinking I'm so great being an I have no possessions. Prabhupada's words shattered my ego. I felt so ashamed. How little I know. It were talks like this that really began to transform my heart. He gave an example. If you water the root of a tree, then that water would extend to every part of the tree, all the flowers, the leaves, the twigs. And similarly, janmadya shayataha, aham sarvasya prabhavo matya sarvam pravartite, iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanbhata. Krishna tells in the Gita, I am the source of all material and spiritual worlds. Everything emanates from me. Aham bija pratapita. And everyone emanates from Krishna. Therefore, he is the father and the mother of all beings. When we learn to love God, when we offer our devotion to Krishna, then our love will extend to every part of the tree of Krishna. Krishna is the root. Whether one is black or white or red or yellow or eastern or western or rich or poor or educated or uneducated, whatever one's religion, whatever one's caste, whatever one's species, Vidyavanaya sampane brahmani gabihastini suni chaiva supake cha pandita samadarshana. When we actually begin to develop love for God within our hearts, the test of that love is it is expressed through compassion to all living beings. And in the path of bhakti, the practical method of awakening that love that is inherent within us is associating with people who have that love, or those who are sincerely and honestly striving for that love. And actually learning the Gita and these great scriptures from parampara, from the great lines of saints who have lived by these principles. Satsang, living with character, living in a mood of service rather than exploitation, and especially chanting sacred mantras, chanting God's holy names. These are the activities that serve like water, that nourish the root of our love for Krishna and actually make us instruments of God's grace in everything we do. I decided in my life I wanted to assist in this wonderful mission of opening people's hearts to understand their true potential. I received the ultimate treasure of my life from the people of India, and ultimately from my beloved Guru. And I have no way I could possibly repay it. The journey home is a very simple, humble attempt, especially to share with the people of India what someone who has come from the outside have discovered and been transformed by what your fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers and your and the sages and rishis of your great country is giving to the world. Krishna means all attractive, all beautiful, the ultimate object of love. It's not a sectarian concept. It's a universal principle. I'll end with one little story that Srila Prabhupada told. When Lord Chaitanya was traveling in South India, not too far from here, a place called Kurukshetra, he was invited to a home of a very wealthy Brahmin. And that Brahmin was so inspired by Sri Chaitanya, who was that time a sannyasi just traveling. He said, "I am suffering the pangs of materialistic life. I want to leave my family, my wealth, my occupation, my everything, and I want to follow you." And Sri Chaitanya told him, "There's no need for that." He said, "You remain at home. You take care of your family. You continue your occupation. But live with character. Live in a spirit of seva, service. Don't see anything as yours. Be the caretaker of God's property. And you will realize this by always chanting Krishna's holy names, associating with saintly people, and hearing from them the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. And if you do these simple things, live purely, chant God's names, associate with saintly people, then there's no need to leave your family, your occupation. Spiritual life is not about changing our circumstance. It's about changing our hearts. I'm a Swami. I chose this path. Not out of some serious decision. It's just natural for me to be like this. But when I see people like Rishikesh Mufatlal and others here, Radha Priya, his good wife, Rekha, as an example, they are as saintly. They have as much deep yogic realizations as swamis or sadhus. because they are offering whatever they do for that higher purpose of being an instrument of God's compassion in their lives. The journey home is a little offering to express the incredible appreciation I have for what I have received from your great nation. Thank you very much.